Mota sabago ato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay, so we'll continue in this first chapter, Mindfulness, the Gatekeeper. And yesterday, we were going over the kind of the interplay or interface between right view, right mindfulness, right effort. And this next section is kind of titled The Governing Principle. So picking that out as a theme for mindfulness. Okay, when we consider all the elements of the Satipatthana formula, we can see that right mindfulness plays a supervisory role in keeping your practice on the right path. It remembers, from right view, how to recognize the right path from the wrong path. It also remembers to stay alert and focused on the task at hand. It motivates right effort by remembering why the right path is worth following. At the same time, reminding right effort of what to do to stay on the path. Right mindfulness also incorporates right effort in its own activity of subduing any concerns that would pull the practice off course. Right effort, in turn, tries to keep right mindfulness established, maintaining it and furthering its development. This interplay of mutual support explains why some maps of the practice, such as the seven factors for awakening, place right mindfulness before right effort, whereas others, such as the five faculties and the Noble Eightfold Path, place right effort before right mindfulness. The supervisory role played by right mindfulness is in line with the Buddha's observation in Anguttara 10, Sutta number 58, that, quote, all phenomena have mindfulness as their governing principle. And that's the same sutta that I read out, having that all things are rooted in desire, which was the first. Anyway, that's a sutta where these different points are drawn out. So all phenomena have mindfulness as their governing principle. Mindfulness, whether right or wrong, is a factor present in any experience where memories from the past are brought to bear on what is happening within that experience. It supplies a framework for understanding the experience. It can remember motivating reasons for why the framework should be applied, while the framework in turn indicates what action or actions should be performed. If the framework or motivation is wrong, the resulting action is likely to be detrimental. The Buddha, in including right mindfulness in the path, takes the role that mindfulness plays in any experience where memory is brought to bear on the present and points it in a skillful direction. This is an important point to note. Instead of telling you to abandon past memories so as to approach the present with totally fresh eyes and bare awareness, he's saying to be selective in calling on the appropriate memories that will help keep you on the path to the end of suffering. And instead of telling you to watch passively as things arise and pass away on their own, He's saying to keep remembering the need to complete any uncompleted tasks required by the path and to protect any attainments that have already been attained. In other words, there are some things you have to remember to make arise and to prevent from passing away. Okay, any questions? Ajahn Jeff is taking a poke at some of the assumptions that or popular notions about mindfulness and recognizing that they're not so consummate with not meshing so well with the how the Buddha himself laid things out.
One thing he mentions in his book Self and Not Self is he sort of points out, it's like, look, we're doing this all the time.
Yeah.
Subconsciously, even if we think we're practicing bare awareness, we're still being selective about our memories, selective about our experience.
Totally.
And all the Buddha's teaching us is to be deliberate about it.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's just the way the mind works. It's just and again, it sort of comes back to that romantic ideal of something that it'd be nice if it were like this, but actually reality doesn't accord with that. So that the nature of the mind is such that memory and perceptions and biases and moods and thoughts are constantly arising, and how do we navigate that rather than wishing they weren't there? And it's like trying to sort of like setting up a utopian existence in the mind, which utopias very rarely come to fruition.
Yeah, kind of along those lines too. It's learning from Ajahn Sona, like, because I had this idea for a long time of, like, say if you're depressed or angry, you're like, I'm just watching the anger, but like you're actually not just watching it, you're keeping it going, generating it. So this idea of just watching it,
well,
which I think he's also working
on. Yeah. Yes, there is that element. Because as long as one is passively acquiescing to negative states, and one is feeding them, and one is supporting them.
So then, if you recognize that you're angry, do you exert right effort to abandon that anger?
That's where right effort, you start seeing these options in right effort of the right effort for abandoning, or the effort for preventing it from it coming up, noticing the causes so one can actually prevent it. Dissecting it in some way, or shifting it to how do we bring up what's positive, what's wholesome, because then that changes the shape of everything as well. If one puts forth the effort to for the arising of wholesome states, and then it sort of one is recognizing, okay, this isn't helpful, and okay, now how can I put forth the effort and attention in supporting the wholesome and the skillful.
Well, I have a question. Is what you're reading about, is using the term mindfulness, is it implied that that's right mindfulness, or is adding the term right add a whole other layer to others?
Right adds a whole other layer of understanding. Mindfulness, well, it depends how it's, it depends how it's how it is presented, in the sense that it depends on context. Because mindfulness on itself can be either right or wrong, or skillful or unskillful. But then oftentimes how we use mindfulness is oftentimes implying or implicit that it's mindfulness that is you're using in conjunction with the path, so should therefore be kind of right mindfulness, and then imply, and then also mindfulness in terms of the constellation of qualities that it includes. Say like effort, a compunction, that sense of having a sense of restraint, having a relinquishment. So they tend to be implied within that, but you have to look at the context.
So in the passage that you're reading, would you say that's an example where right mindfulness is implied?
Yes, although he he is also he does sort of draw out that point that it is he's actually using it in both ways, in the sense that mindfulness, whether right or wrong, is a factor present in any experience where memories for the so then it has the whole spectrum. Because it's especially in the Abhidhamma analysis of mental states, all states of mind have some form of mindfulness, in the sense that again, right or wrong, there has to be, because there's an integrating of memory and an integrating of attention, and then there is, and whether the memories are skewed and the attention is focused on something that isn't useful, that mindfulness is drawing it out in each mental state.
I'm supposed to be angry at this person. That's like wrong mindfulness.
Yeah, it's like how our mindfulness is selective, in the same way that our memory is selective, and they're feeding each other. Of course, these are that sense of what's that. I can't remember the exact wording, but it's sort of the khandhas being
conjoined.
Yes, conjoined. Thank you. They're conjoined. They are not disjoined, so that you can't just sort of pull out different factors of feeling and perception and memory and thought, and say they stand alone. It's they're conjoined. They work together. They function together. Okay. There's a quote that Ajahn Jeff uses to illustrate the sense of the mindfulness as its governing principle. And I'll read the quote, and then I went and looked it up, and it's actually a really interesting sutta, so I thought I'd read the whole sutta, because it covers more ground than just mindfulness, but we're not in a big rush to get anywhere. Yeah, so this is illustrating this point. In other words, there are some things you have to remember to make arise and to prevent from passing away. Okay, so the quote that he uses is from Anguttara 4, Sutta number 245. This holy life is lived with mindfulness as its governing principle. And how is mindfulness the governing principle? The mindfulness that I will make any training with regard to good conduct that is not yet complete, or I will protect with discernment any training with regard to good conduct that is complete. This is well established right within. The mindfulness that, quote, I will make complete any training with regard to the basics of the holy life that is not yet complete, or I will protect with discernment any training with regard to the basics of the holy life that is complete, end of quote, is well established right within. The mindfulness that I will scrutinize with discernment any Dhamma that is not yet scrutinized, or I will protect with discernment any Dhamma that has been scrutinized, is well established right within. The mindfulness that I will touch through release any Dhamma that is not yet touched, or I will protect with discernment any Dhamma that has been touched, is well established right within. This is how mindfulness is the governing principle. The sutta is actually titled Sikha Sutta, so it's the sutta on training. And and it begins with, and I'll read the whole sutta from Bhikkhu Bodhi's. And one is in the sense of getting a comparison to the just the phraseology. But it starts with, of course, it's in Anguttara 4, so that there's four things that are being illuminated. And said, because this spiritual life is lived with the training as its benefit, with wisdom as its supervisor, with liberation at its as its core, and with mindfulness as its authority. And that so that how Ajahn Jeff said mindfulness as its governing principle, and Bhikkhu Bodhi says mindfulness as its authority. The word that is from the Pali, adipatthaya, which is it's one that that's a word that I, although is when I oftentimes bring up the difference. There's adipatthaya is like what is predominant or what is has strength, so that loka adipatthaya is dominant, so the world is dominant. Atta adipatthaya, the self is dominant, or is governing principle, has authority. Or dhamma adipatthaya. Okay, so having the dhamma as the so those are that's a set of teachings that is and in this adipatthaya is using that governing principle or authority or what has kind of oomph in the mind, so using mindfulness and saying that this is as the and the way that Ajahn Jeff translate, okay, this holy life is lived with training as a reward, it's anisangsa in Thai, it's a very ordinary word that's used in the just any soul as its benefit, wisdom as its supervisor, and Ajahn Jeff has discernment as its surpassing state, uttara, that's its kind of highest, its peak. So wisdom as its supervisor, and then with release as its heartwood, or with Bhikkhu Bodhi, with liberation as its core, and its vimutti sara. So sara is what has the essence, maybe, is another word. Okay, bhikkhus, this spiritual life is lived with the training as its benefit, with wisdom as its supervisor, with liberation as its core, and with mindfulness as its authority. One, and how, bhikkhus, is training its benefit? Here, the training pertaining to proper conduct has been prescribed by me to my disciples so that those without confidence gain confidence, and those with confidence increase in their confidence. One takes up this training pertaining to proper conduct in just the way that I have prescribed it to my disciples, keeping it unbroken, flawless, unblemished, and unblotched, so that those without confidence gain confidence, and those with confidence increase in their confidence. Having undertaken them, one trains in the training rules. Again, the training fundamental to the spiritual life has been prescribed by me to my disciples for the utterly complete destruction of suffering. One takes up this training fundamental to the spiritual life in just the way that I have prescribed it to my disciples for the utterly complete destruction of suffering, keeping it unbroken, flawless, unblemished, and unblotched. Having undertaken them, one trains in the training rules. It is in this way that the training is its benefit. 2. And how is wisdom its supervisor? Here the teachings have been taught by me to my disciples for their utterly complete destruction of suffering. One scrutinizes those teachings with wisdom in just the way that I have taught them to my disciples for the utterly complete destruction of suffering. It is in this way that wisdom is its supervisor. 3. And how is liberation its core? Here the teachings have been taught by me to my disciples for the utterly complete destruction of suffering. Through liberation, one experiences those teachings in just the way that I've taught them to my disciples for the utterly complete destruction of suffering. It is in this way that liberation is its core. 4. And how is mindfulness its authority? One's mindfulness is well established internally thus. In just such a way, I will fulfill the training pertaining to good conduct that I have not yet fulfilled, or assist with wisdom in various respects the training pertaining to good conduct that I have fulfilled. And one's mindfulness is well established internally thus. In just such a way, I will fulfill the training pertaining to the fundamentals of the spiritual life that I have not yet fulfilled, or assist with wisdom in various respects the training pertaining to the fundamentals of the spiritual life that I have fulfilled. And one's mindfulness is well established internally thus. In just such a way, I will scrutinize with wisdom the teachings I have not yet scrutinized, or assist with wisdom in various respects the teachings that I have scrutinized. And one's mindfulness is well established internally thus. In just such a way, I will experience through liberation the Dhamma that I have not yet experienced, or assist with wisdom in various respects the Dhamma that I have experienced. It is in this way that mindfulness is its authority. Thus, when it was said, bhikkhus, the spiritual life is lived with the training as its benefit, with wisdom as its supervisor, with liberation at its core, with mindfulness as its authority, it is because of this that this was said. So I thought that was a pretty beefy sutta, pithy, and it sort of really captures the whole spectrum of the teaching, of the kind of. Okay.
Just to point out the obvious, and this is another beautiful example of how intertwined right mindfulness and right effort are.
Yes.
The definition of right mindfulness in this case is.
Is right. Yes. It's, this is there again. They're They are conjoined, they're not disjoined. These work together. So he continues on. Several similes and descriptions in the discourses give a sense of how mindfulness plays this supervisory role. In Sutta Nipata 1, Sutta number 4, for instance, the Buddha compares mindfulness to a goad, a sharp implement that a farmer uses to poke a beast of burden that has become distracted from its task. To remind it of its task, to warn it of the dangers of forgetting its task, and to get it moving. In this simile, the beast of burden is persistence. In the same way, mindfulness serves to poke right effort to change its focus from unskillful distractions, such as greed and distress with reference to the world, and to direct it back to the duties dictated by the proper frame of reference. So I thought I would read that sutta. It's kind of a well-known sutta. And so Sutta Nipata 1, Sutta number 4. It's of the farmer Bharadvaja. Kasi Bharadvaja reproaches the Buddha with idleness, but the latter convinces him that he also works. Thus have I heard. Once the Blessed One was dwelling in a Brahmin village called Ekanala, situated in the district of Dakinagiri in the country of Magadha. At that time, being the sowing season, 500 ploughs owned by the Brahmin Kasi Bharadvaja were set to work. In the morning then, the Buddha, having robed himself and taking his bowl and double-layered robe, went to that place where Kasi Bharadvaja's work was in progress. It was lunchtime and the food was being distributed by the Brahmin. When the Buddha arrived at the place where the food was being distributed, he stood aside. The Brahmin, seeing the Buddha standing for alms, said thus, "O recluse, I plow and sow, and having plowed and sown, I eat. You also, recluse, should plow and sow, and having plowed and sown, you should eat." So basically, go get a job. "I too, Brahmin, plow and sow, and having plowed and sown, I eat." And then the Brahmin replied, "We see neither yoke, nor plow, nor plowshare, nor goad, nor oxen of the venerable Gotama, and yet you say, 'I too, Brahmin, plow and sow, and having plowed and sown, I eat.'" Thereupon Kasi Bharadvaja addressed the Buddha in this stanza, "You claim to be a farmer, yet we do not see your plowing. Being questioned by us about your plowing, tell us in such a manner that we may know of it." And then the Buddha replies, "Confidence is the seed, self-control the rein, wisdom my yoke and plow, modesty is my pole, mind is the rope, mindfulness my plowshare and goad. Bodily action is well guarded, speech is well guarded. Moderate in food, I make truth the destroyer of weeds and calm my release. Exertion is my yoked oxen, which carries me toward Nibbana. It goes onward without stopping. Having gone there, one has no regrets. In this way, the plowing is done. It bears the fruit of immortality. Having accomplished this plowing, one becomes free from all suffering." Then Kasi Bharadvaja filled a large golden bowl with milk rice and offered it to the Buddha, saying, "Let the venerable Gotama eat the milk rice. You are a farmer by reason of that plowing. It bears indeed the fruit of immortality." And then the Buddha replies, "What is obtained by chanting hymns is not to be eaten by me. This is, Brahman, not the practice of those who see rightly. The Buddhas refuse what is obtained by chanting hymns. You should observe other fruit. You should serve other food and drink to an accomplished great sage who is free from the mental impurities and remorse. That is the field for him who seeks merits. Then, Venerable Gotama, to whom should I give this milk rice? Brahman in the world, which includes gods, Maras, Brahmas, and among Brahmins and men, I do not see anyone except a Tathagata or a disciple of a Tathagata by whom this milk rice, when eaten, can be properly digested. Therefore, O Brahman, you had better cast this milk rice either in a place where there is no grass or float it in water where there are no living creatures. So Kasi Bharadvaja floated this milk rice in water which contained no life, whereupon it made a hissing sound with much steam and smoke emanating from all sides. Just as a plowshare, when heated all day and plunged into water, produces a hissing sound and emits steam and smoke on all sides. Then Kasi Bharadvaja, greatly excited and with hair standing on end, approached the Buddha and fell with his head at the Master's feet, saying, "It is amazing, Venerable Gotama, it is wonderful, Venerable Gotama. Just as if one might raise what has been overturned, or reveal what has been hidden, or point out the way to him who has gone astray, or hold out a lamp in the dark so that those who have eyes may see objects, so likewise has the truth been explained by the Venerable Gotama in various ways. Therefore I take refuge in him, his Dhamma, and his Sangha. I wish to enter the homeless life and to receive the higher ordination near the Venerable Gotama." Then Kasi Bharadvaja received ordination as a novice and received the higher ordination near the Buddha. Later, by leading a secluded life diligently, energetically, and with a resolute will, in a short time he understood, experienced, and attained that highest perfection of a noble life for which the sons of good family leave the household life harmoniously and take to the life of homelessness. Rebirth had been ended, a noble life had been led. What was to be done had been done, and there was nothing else to be done in this earthly existence. Kasi Bharadvaja had become one of the perfected ones. So, in some ways, a trope. There's that nice setting out of what they... the work of a samana, a practitioner. Confidence is the seed, self-control the rein. Wisdom, my yoke and plow. Modesty is my pole. Mind is the rope. Mindfulness, my plowshare and goad. Bodily action is well guarded. Speech is well guarded. Moderate in food, I make truth the destroyer of weeds and calm my release. Exertion is my yoked oxen, which carries me toward Nibbana. It goes onward without stopping. Having gone there, one has no regrets. In this way, the plowing is done. It bears the fruit of immortality. Having accomplished this plowing, one becomes free from all suffering. So it's a very beautiful description. Yeah.
What word is the translated rendering as immortality?
Probably the deathless. The Amata Dhamma. Yeah. Amata Dhamma, the deathless.
Immortality does have a different connotation than the usual use of.
Yeah, it's true too. Yeah. So it'd be the deathless. As Dr. Sadachisa translated this. Let me say here.
What is a plowshare?
A plowshare? That's what it cuts into the ground when you're plowing.
So it's, mindfulness is both the goad, the thing that pokes the beast in her, and the plowshare.
Yeah. Does a lot of work.
Yeah. I'm still trying to digest this kind of Dhamma, and you know, just being a lay minor practitioner. Kind of hard for me to really put all the words, but it sounds like right mindfulness really kind of boils down to choice, whereas, well, mindfulness in general, choice. So back to the anger example, you know, you, through just awareness, you acknowledge that you were angry, and the mindfulness involved with that is the wrong mindfulness, you know, the memory of what caused the anger. Right mindfulness is kind of recognizing the suffering that your anger is causing for yourself, and so exerting the right effort to change the conditions of your mind to go towards more wholesome states.
Right. Well, I think also what it is also recognizing that my mindfulness has this function of being aware, alert, attentive, and yeah, open to choice. But then it's also helping to integrate the aspects of effort and discernment, so that those are, you know, they have different names, but they have to work together. And I think that's one of the functions of mindfulness, is giving a template whereby these different aspects can be attended to and then help to integrate. That's it. But I think it's one of the things we tend to, when the nature of say of definition, when we try to define something, naturally ends up limiting what its spectrum of possibilities are. So then, I think it's helpful to reckon, okay, when we try to get our mind around something, we're defining it, but then we also have to not hold it too tightly so that we can see the possibilities that are implicit in that as well.
Well, if this helps, but I think one of the things I've just seen, just being here this last year, seeing like sort of patterns of practice, of just sort of like this tendency of the mind wanting to like, you know, give me the plan, give me the rule, so I'll follow it, and then not think about it anymore. You know, Lampa and others are really good about not sort of giving that to me. and while that's, it's like he was saying, it's like, you know, he's trying to help open the mind as opposed to narrow its selection.
Yeah.
I think too, like, I like to think of it as like the practice is like learning how to do some sort of maybe very difficult surgery, and it's like not readily apparent when you first start doing it or learning the technique how exactly everything's gonna kind of fit together. But like, I think so, this idea of like being forgiving of oneself, like that you haven't learned how to do this like brain transplant or whatever in like 1 month or like 12 or whatever to learn it. So it's like, I think with the anger thing too, it's like, if you can't get rid of it, then it's okay. It's okay too.
or part of the process of dealing with something like that is actually understanding it in the first part. It doesn't mean
just,
you know, yeah, you know. So
yeah.
You experience, you allow the experience, you just don't act on it in a way that perpetuates it. So you do have to understand it as an experience before you jump into dealing with it.
Yeah.
You can't just repress it and pretend that it's not there, but you don't have to move into it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you start realizing that there's a lot, you know, some of like our habits of mind are so deeply ingrained that's where, yeah, on an ideal level, and you put it out on paper, it's, yeah, well, you just, yeah, you get, you relinquish it, or you get rid of it, or you do something else, or you penetrate it with wisdom, and all of that, and but you know, the reality is it's still there. And then it's sort of being, and that's where the, you start realizing, okay, this actual application of mindfulness and discernment and effort start to include all sorts of other aspects of the path. Well, okay, like, oh, patience. I can't remember how many times, we couldn't possibly remember the number of times going to Ajahn Chah that we would, you know, ask for some kind of, clear sort of way of doing, dealing with a particular difficulty or problem. And you just have to learn how to be patient. And, it's not what you want to hear. And you just want to get rid of it. And just learning how to be patient is so that's an incredible practice in itself. Or learning how to have loving kindness and compassion. Those are so that you're starting to learn how to you realize, oh yeah, these are all kind of part of the toolkit that we cultivate and develop and learn how to use, and they're incredibly important. And then there starts to be a very healthy concern or care that one learns in dealing with the mind, because it's saying, wow, this is really deeply ingrained, and this is not, you can't wave a magic wand of one's sort of wishes and make it disappear. So that one requires a certain level of healthy skepticism of one's own habits, healthy kind of respect for the power of the mind. Okay, well, I need to be careful with that. And we start realizing how, okay, this is going to take time.
That's the thing about patience. It reminds me of going through deep grief. You know, at the beginning it's just this fog and it's very, very intense. Mm-hmm. But over time, it becomes a little clearer and it's letting go piece by piece. That's a factor of time and patience.
Yeah.
And acceptance.
Yeah, and a willingness to let it be there rather than trying to cover it over or push it away. Or indulge in it. Yes, it's another option that people have.
Is that simple statement of what we're doing? I think it was the king who asked him if he still had anger. And he just said, yes, but I don't take it.
Yes, well, Ajahn was actually both Lumpo Doon as well as Lumpo Cha. It's similar sort of reply and say, yeah, you still have anger? Yeah. I said, wow, I thought you were supposed to be an arahant. And he said, but I don't use it. And then don't pick it up. Well, I mean, the thing is if you don't pick it up, do you have it or not? You know, in the sense that, you know, if it's, because that's you look at some of the suttas are written in a particular way. You look at some of the exchanges that the Buddha had. And he definitely displayed, a dislike for a particular activity, and a preference for not doing that. So do you call that anger, or do you say, well, no, it's just this is part of the spectrum of human reaction or moods that come into the mind. And then how's it held? How's it dealt with?
in a symbolic way, like with all the times that after the Buddha's enlightenment, Mara would still come,
right.
You know, and tempt or challenge him with, you know, mood, mind states, that kind of stuff. But I know you, Mara.
Yeah. And so it's you know, sometimes it's hard to parse that out in the language that we're familiar with. But I think it's we tend to our cultural kind of conditioning goes to an idealism and an idealizing of and I think that my own experience of living close to say a teacher who was considered an arahant. Yeah, ideals are, he would just either contradict whatever ideals you set for him or just throw out any kind of ideals that other people projected on him. It would really, really frustrating. Mm-hmm.